My name's Tony Riches, and I'm a full-time historical fiction author living in Pembrokeshire, Wales, UK, which is probably known to you as the birthplace of Henry Tudor. And in fact, I was born in Pembroke, within sight of Pembroke Castle, which is perhaps where my fascination with the Tudor dynasty originated. And I'm best known for my Tudor trilogy, but there are now three books which I call sequels, as they continue the story of the Tudors from the founding of the dynasty by Owen Tudor right through to the coronation of Queen Elizabeth I and my Elizabethan series, which I'm now researching. And I began researching the life of Charles Brandon when I was writing my book about Mary Tudor. This is Henry VIII's sister, Mary Tudor, Queen of France, not his daughter. And the book is called Mary Tudor, Princess. And I became fascinated by the character of Charles Brandon and decided that he deserved to have a book himself. And of course, I could then revisit all the research I'd done for Mary and look at it from Charles Brandon's point of view, which was fascinating as a writer. Now, Mary was supposed to have married the young Emperor Charles and become Empress of Rome. But after her father, Henry VII, had died, her brother, King Henry VIII, saw an opportunity and offered her in marriage to King Louis of France. Now, poor old Louis had had a bit of a hard life and was not quite on his deathbed, but not far from it. And he was 30 years older than her. And you might have imagined that Mary would have been a bit miffed at the prospect of marrying him. But in fact, we have to look at it in the perspective of Tudor times. She saw it as her duty. And I think she quite liked the idea of being Queen of France. And right to her death, she preferred to be referred to as the Queen Dowager of France rather than Duchess of Suffolk. I don't think she hardly ever called herself the Duchess of Suffolk. Anyway, when Louis died, they'd only been married 3 months, and it was Christmas Eve 1514. By the way, he didn't die, I don't believe, as some said at the time, from the exertion of satisfying his young wife. He had multiple illnesses, including gout, and we don't really know what else. But when he died, Henry sent his best friend, Charles Brandon, to bring Mary safely back home. Now, Mary is said to have agreed with Henry that part of the condition for agreeing to marry Louis is that her next marriage would be to someone of her own choosing. And perhaps Henry was mindful of this when he made Charles Brandon promise not to marry her. So the big question is, why did Charles Brandon risk everything by disobeying the king? And the answer is complex. I find it hard not to picture the actor Henry Cavill, who played Charles Brandon in the TV series The Tudors. But it is true that Charles Brandon was handsome and charming. He was a champion jouster, and he was the best friend of the king and had been since boyhood. Brandon was born in 1484. The actual month and day isn't documented, but his Tudor roots are deep, because it's quite likely that he was actually born in France while his parents were in exile there with Henry Tudor and Jasper Tudor, preparing for the invasion of England. So Charles Brandon's father, William, was Henry VII's standard bearer. And at the Battle of Bosworth, he was one of the few men thought to have been killed by Richard III in the battle. It's impossible to tell from the surviving accounts, but I believe he might have been able to defend himself better if he'd not been quite so determined to protect the Tudor standard. And we see something of that in Charles later on with his really quite unswerving loyalty to Henry. Almost whatever Henry does, Charles Brandon's able to go along with it. But after his father died, young Charles was taken into King Henry VII's household and grew up as a companion to the young Henry VIII. He would have known Henry's sisters, the princesses Margaret and Mary, but there isn't much mention of it anywhere that I can find until he was much older. But they were kind of shut away from the world by their father, Henry VII. After the loss of Arthur, he really did keep a very tight rein on Henry, the young Henry, and didn't allow him to do anything which was at all dangerous. And I suspect Margaret and Mary had a bit of a sheltered life as well. But Brandon was brought up really as a trainee courtier and became a favourite of King Henry VII, as well as a childhood friend of his second son. And really, there are three things to consider when we're trying to understand why Brandon took such a risk marrying Mary, which could easily have been construed by his enemies as treason, a treasonable act against the king, for which he should pay the ultimate penalty. Really, the first of these things is Mary's changed circumstances. The second is Brandon's situation. And thirdly, Henry VIII's attitude to them both. So Mary, after the king died, was sent off to live really under house arrest in a convent because they had to be absolutely certain that she wasn't carrying the king's heir. So they didn't want her getting near any other men, that was for sure. And her stepson, I mean, I use the term, he wasn't much different in age, of course, from Mary, but the new King Francis was already planning to marry her off to the highest bidder, really. It was his right to do so, and he could gain something politically as well as financially. And Mary needed a way out, and quick. For Brandon, the prospect of marriage into the royal family must have been quite attractive, because it would finally lay to rest the continual sniping from the men of the old nobility, particularly the Duke of Norfolk. Brandon's ancestors were servants to the Howards, and that's something that Thomas Howard found it hard to overlook. And it's also worth noting that if Brandon married Mary and then they had a son, he would be in the direct line of succession, given Henry's failure to produce a son. Any son they had could become King of England. So Brandon had already been married twice. First, he'd promised to marry Anne Brown, and then surprised everyone by marrying a wealthy widow, Dame Margaret Neville, who was twice his age. And he promptly began selling her lands and property until most of it was gone, when he had the marriage annulled, and then returned to Anne Brown and married her. It was interesting in the book to consider how Anne might have viewed all of this. But they had two daughters, Anne and Mary Brandon, before Anne died, sadly, in 1510. And then if we move forward to 1513, Brandon became Viscount Lisle. Now, this is interesting because it was quite typical at the time that people would purchase wardships for strategic reasons. Brandon had a good twist on it, because he used to borrow the money quite often from the king or from somebody like Thomas Wolsey. And in the particular case, his ward was Elizabeth Grey, who was Viscountess Lisle. And by default, Brandon inherited her title. And another interesting one, in the same year, the king was visiting Margaret of Austria with Charles Brandon, and there was a bit of a scandal in that it's what the Tudors would call a game of courtly love, but Brandon caused a scandal by taking a ring from the Duchess of Savoy's finger and then basically threatening not to give it back unless she agreed to marry him. So rumours spread probably throughout Europe that Brandon and the Duchess would marry, but Henry VIII was embarrassed by it all and had to make denials. But the following year, he did make Charles Brandon the Duke of Suffolk. Now, at the time, the only other duke around was the Duke of Norfolk, so it probably increased the rivalry between them. They had a kind of on-off rivalry all of their lives, I think. And the effect of becoming Duke, it made Charles Brandon one of the most eligible bachelors in the country. And of course, Mary would have been very much aware of this. And if Henry didn't think that Brandon might consider marrying his little sister, then why did he bother forbidding it? And part of the answer might be that he really didn't want King Francis to gain any advantage from his sister. And at the same time, I think Thomas Wolsey might have been behind this, is that they saw a good excuse to confiscate Mary's fortune, including all the jewellery her father had given her before he died, and the crown jewels of France that had come into her possession as gifts from a grateful King Louis over the 3 months they were together. And that's exactly what he did. When he told Brandon and Mary that they were forgiven and they returned to England, he confiscated everything they had. And this included a priceless jewel called the Mirror of Naples, which you might have heard of. It's described variously as a gem as wide as a full finger width, with a pearl dangling from it the size of a pigeon's egg. Now, the new King of France, Francis, insisted that the Mirror of Naples was very much part of the crown jewels of France. And Henry's response was to wear it in his hat as taunt the French. Now, Brandon and Mary had four children. The first, sadly, died. He was named Henry Brandon. He died as a child. And the circumstances are a little bit hazy, but it wasn't unusual. Child mortality was very high, even amongst the wealthy. And the daughter, Frances Brandon, eventually became mother of the ill-fated Lady Jane Grey. So there's an interesting connection through there. The other daughter, Eleanor Brandon, became the Countess of Cumberland. And interestingly, she was the chief mourner at the funeral of Catherine of Aragon. And then their second son, who they imaginatively also named Henry Brandon. So there's a lot of confusion about all these Henry Brandons. But this is the second son of Brandon and Mary. He was made Earl of Lincoln and became the only male in the line of succession who was English. But sadly, he died at the age of 11. Charles Brandon led the jousting at the meeting of Henry VIII and King Francis in what has become known as the Field of the Cloth of Gold in 1520. And in 1523, he was sent to Calais to command the English troops on an invasion of France in company with Flemish troops. They did pretty well at the beginning. And ransacked the north of France, but winter was coming and the troops started mutinying. The conditions were appalling, and Charles Brandon discovered he wasn't really cut out to be a great leader. So he disbanded his army, and they limped their way back to Calais. And I believe that Charles Brandon barely escaped with his life and was never quite the same after that, because he suffered greatly, perhaps with frostbite and poor food and water and things like that. But when he returned, of course, he discovered that Henry VIII had decided to go public with his relationship with a lady called Anne Boleyn. And it was complicated for Charles because his wife Mary was best friends with Catherine of Aragon and detested the Boleyn family and actually spoke out. She was one of the few people, I think, that would dare to speak out against Anne Boleyn. But Henry would have none of it, of course, and he made Charles Brandon high steward at his wedding in 1533 and rewarded him with land which had resulted from the dissolution of the monasteries. And this pattern continues because in 1544, Charles Brandon was made Captain General of the army and once again sent off to France for the siege of Boulogne. It wasn't a long siege, it was about 6 weeks, and they spent the whole 6 weeks pounding the defences of Boulogne with cannons, digging tunnels and trenches and generally making a nuisance of themselves. And Boulogne surrendered in the end, and Brandon rode into the city in triumph to accept their surrender and became something of a national hero. In my book, Brandon Tudor Knight, I decided that really Charles Brandon was the last of what I call the true Tudor Knights, in that he was fiercely proud to be a Knight of the Garter and really bought into all the chivalry and the idea that being a champion jouster was very much being part of being a knight. And I wanted to understand more about the places that he lived and his world, really. So I began visiting as many of the locations as I could. And one of the most interesting was when I visited his manor house at Westhorpe in Suffolk. And the house features quite prominently in my book, and I needed to have a sense of the scale of the place and the layout and the countryside and its location in the Suffolk landscape. So Westhorpe became the main home for the Brandon family up to the time of Mary Tudor's death. And Charles Brandon, having been made Duke of Suffolk, built Westhorpe using Mary's dower income as Queen of France. And he used a moated site, which had previously belonged to the de la Pole family, but the new building was on a much grander scale. And of course, when Mary died, her French income ceased, and Charles Brandon found himself back in debt to the crown. So rather cleverly, he decided this time he would marry his 14-year-old ward, who was the wealthy heiress Catherine Willoughby, which he did barely 3 months after Mary Tudor's death. And by chance, the day that he married her, 7th September, was the day Elizabeth I was born. And I found an inventory of the property which had been taken in 1538, which records a moated house of brick decorated with terracotta panels built round an open courtyard 126 feet square. So the main range of the house was on the eastern side, and it was approached from the west over the moat by an arched bridge. And intriguingly, the bridge is still there to this day, and you can really get a sense of what it might have been like to approach the house over it. And the 1538 inventory also describes a brick gatehouse with battlements and turrets, three stories high, flanked by three rooms with corner towers, and that all the windows were well glassed and the walls of brick laid over with plaster. This is an interesting detail. It says that it was decorated checkerwise, white and black, and all the house covered with tile, and the gatehouse and towers covered with lead. Sadly, Westhorpe wasn't looked after terribly well after Charles Brandon had finished with it, and it was largely demolished in the late 1760s. And it was visited by the antiquarian Thomas Martin of Palgrave, who wrote, "I went to see the dismal ruins of Westhorpe Hall, formerly the seat of Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk. The workmen are now pulling it down as fast as may be, in a very careless and injudicious manner. The copering, bricks, battlements, and many other ornamental pieces are made of earth and burnt hard." That's the terracotta he's talking about there. "As fresh as when first built, they might with care have been taken down whole, but all the fine chimneys and ornaments were pulled down with ropes and crushed to pieces in a most shameful manner. There was a monstrous figure of Hercules sitting cross-legged with his club and a lion beside him, but all were shattered to pieces. The painted glass is likely to share the same fate, but the timber is fresh and sound, and the building, which was very lofty, stood as when it was first built. It is a pity that care is not taken to preserve some few of our ancient fabrics." And in 1839, John Wotherspoon, in his book Historic Sites and Other Remarkable and Interesting Places in the County of Suffolk, notes that the whole of Westhorpe was of large dimensions and had attached a chapel with cloisters, in which existed a fine window of stained glass. The gardens of large extent were kept in the style of the continental pleasure grounds, the princess having imbibed a taste for the conceits of the French mode of gardening by her brief sojourn in France. The whole building is, however, removed. Now, in 1988, there was an archaeological dig to see how accurate these descriptions were, and particularly to look at whether it really was such a big gatehouse. And they exposed the floor as well as part of the inner courtyard. And the most interesting thing for me was that they drained the moat, which is still there, by the way, and it was full of these chunks of terracotta, and each piece was documented. And I actually met the owner of the house, the current owner, and he took me to a barn and showed me great crates full of terracotta, and I was able to look at one and see the roaring lion emblem of Charles Brandon clearly preserved on it, as if probably looking much as it did in his own time. So that was fascinating, to actually hold a piece of Charles Brandon's manor house in my hand. But in 1991, English Heritage funded a project to make further study of these, and there's a report which is quite interesting as a result of that study. And it also comments on the Brandon's coat of arms, which is over the doorway of the present building, which is a rest home. But as a result of that, the whole area became a scheduled ancient monument. And it is fascinating to visit. And of course, that part of Suffolk is particularly nice. And I got more than enough detailed information to add a bit of authenticity to my book. But to return to the story of the life of Charles Brandon, his marriage to Catherine Willoughby was surprisingly successful, and they had two sons. One, unsurprisingly, was Henry Brandon, so that's the third Henry Brandon, and there's possibility there might have even been the fourth Henry Brandon. And the other one they imaginatively named Charles Brandon, so there's another bit of scope for confusion. But these two were surprisingly, well, they were very gifted, and interestingly, Charles Brandon's sons became companions to the young Prince Edward, who eventually became King Edward, of course, for a short while. So they had the benefit of the best tutors and actually went to university as teenagers. And sadly, both of them died on the same day from the sweating sickness, which was ravaging the country. Historians are still a bit divided as to exactly what the sweating sickness was. But one thing that's for sure is that it was very difficult to recover from, and most people, rich or poor, were dead and delirious, sweating within 24 hours. Brandon knew nothing of this, of course, because he predeceased them. But as he grew older, there's quite a few comments, particularly from ambassadors, who said that he looked very much like Henry VIII. Same kind of shape and quite a striking figure. And he was often mistaken for the king. And Thomas Cromwell's reforms to the royal household created the new position of Lord Great Master to oversee everything. Really, Henry VIII was tired of trying to oversee everything personally. And Charles Brandon was the first person to hold this post until his death. And it's interesting that he lived a full and active life right up to the day he died, which by another amazing coincidence was on the 22nd of August, which of course is the anniversary of the Battle of Bosworth, and the same day as his own father died. The year was 1545, and it's reported as being at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He'd been at a meeting of the Privy Council in Guildford the day before he died, and Catherine was at his bedside with his daughters, Frances and Eleanor, to comfort his last hours. Typically, Charles Brandon asked for a modest funeral, and he was to be buried in the College Church of Tattershall in Lincoln. He'd been granted Tattershall Castle at one point, and was quite fond of that part of the world. And King Henry VIII decided instead that his best friend, perhaps his only lifelong friend, should be buried with full honours at St George's Chapel in Windsor Castle, where he'd been made a Knight of the Garter. Now, I visited Windsor Castle during the research for this book and discovered Charles Brandon's tomb. If you want to go and find it, it's not that easy, because it's easy to walk right past it, because it's not so much a tomb as a stone set into the ground in the fourth bay of the south choir aisle. And it's quite near to the south door. So if you go in the south door, it's right in front of you. But what made it hard to find was it's actually got, when I visited, it had a wooden bench seat on top of it. But if you look out for, there's a life-sized portrait of Edward III, and it's underneath that. And in a funny sort of way, it is as modest as Brandon would have wished. and it was even more modest at one time, but the chapel records show that in 1787 it was ordered that leave be given to lay a new stone above the grave of Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, according to His Majesty's directions. And the stone was put in place when they repaved choir aisles and the nave. And the inscription is quite simple. It only states that Charles Brandon married Mary, daughter of Henry VII, widow of Louis of France. I also found out that the jousting helmet that is on the wall adjacent to his tombstone is nothing to do with him, and it's not a funerary helm, so I could forgive anybody that thought it was Charles Brandon's helmet, but it's just there for decoration. So Charles Brandon was 61 when he died, which in Tudor times was a reasonable age, and he was fortunate in one respect, that he was completely unaware that both his sons would die within an hour of each other in 1551. But I think he would have been amused to know that he lies for eternity alongside Henry VI. If you look through the railings, you can see that they're almost a metre apart, and a few yards away from the equally unimpressive tomb of his lifelong friend and benefactor, Henry VIII. Now, I'd like to end by pointing out that whatever people think of Henry VIII, he assembled his council after Charles Brandon's death and told them that in all their long friendship, Charles Brandon had never knowingly betrayed a friend or taken advantage of an enemy. And he's reported to have asked his council members, "Is there any of you who can say as much?" If you'd like to find out more about my books, full details are on my website, which is at tonyriches.com. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter at Tony Riches, and you'll find me on Facebook under Tony Riches Author. I'd like to thank the Tudor Society for hosting this talk, and to thank you for listening.